Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal, thank you very much. They were the last people you'd expect to be involved in anything strange or mysterious, because they just didn't hold with such nonsense. Welcome to the Basic Cinephile Podcast, Season 1, Harry Potter.
Other host, Adelia. This season on the Basic Cinephile Podcast, we are reading all the Harry Potter books and watching all the Harry Potter movies. And this week we are kicking off episode 1 with the first book, The Sorcerer's Stone.
This podcast contains spoilers. If you have somehow managed to never read Harry Potter, and you think that now, 24 years after it was published, is the time that you want to finally read it, then pause this podcast and come back after you've finally gotten your life in order.
Honestly, I'm just impressed that you've made it this far into life without having any of the Harry Potter books spoiled for you.
At this point, it's harder to have not read the books.
Well done. This isn't the podcast for you. But if you are still interested, let's begin with book number 1. Book 1 begins with Harry and his depressing life at the Dursleys. His aunt and uncle are jerks, but they're still preferable to Harry's cousin Dudley, who is rude and downright abusive towards his cousin. Harry lives in the cupboard under the stairs, and his life is forever changed when he receives a letter addressed to Mr. H. Potter, the cupboard under the stairs, number 4 Privet Drive, Little Whinging, Surrey. Desperate to keep Harry from his letter and from the truth, the Dursleys pack up and flee their home. But a larger-than-life Rubeus Hagrid still manages to find them on Harry's 11th birthday and delivers the fateful news that Harry is a wizard.
Hagrid introduces Harry to the wizarding world and gets him all set to attend Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. Harry quickly learns that the wizarding world and the muggle, or non-magical world, have a lot in common. Some people are generous, like Hagrid, others are rude and elitist, like Draco Malfoy, and others have an insatiable thirst for knowledge, like Hermione Granger.
Harry is sorted into Gryffindor House, where dwell the brave of heart, and quickly becomes best friends with Ron Weasley. The two might not be the smartest boys at Hogwarts, but they manage to get out of the shenanigans that they get themselves into.
Harry is loving it at Hogwarts, because for the first time in his life, he is seen and respected by those around him. Harry has quite the reputation already, because it turns out that the reason he lived with the Dursleys was because the most powerful dark wizard, Voldemort, killed Harry's parents. He attempted to kill Harry too, but the spell backfired. Harry lived, and Voldemort was never seen again.
But something sinister is brewing under the surface. Harry begins to suspect that Professor Snape, the moody potions teacher and head of the detested Slytherin house, is trying to steal the Sorcerer's Stone so that he can bring Voldemort back to life.
Harry, Ron, and Hermione bravely create a plan to thwart Snape's plan, and they decide to go after the stone themselves. But what they discover is something that no one suspected. Voldemort is trying to come back to life, but his loyal minion isn't Snape. It's the stuttering Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, Professor Quirrell.
Through the power of love, a little bit of knowledge, a lot of bravery, and sheer dumb luck, Harry is able to defeat them. The school year at Hogwarts ends, and Harry returns back to number 4 Privet Drive, but this time as a wizard.
So, book 1, the book that started it all, The Sorcerer's Stone, what'd you think?
I have to admit, I liked it a lot more this time around.
Okay.
First time that I read the book, I had already seen the movie beforehand. And because of that, I just kept comparing the two. And I didn't enjoy either one of them, but I was intrigued by the premise of the entire series.
Oh my god. Okay, so that totally throws me off. I had no idea that you didn't read any of the books before the movies.
I didn't read the first book before the movie. Don't get me wrong. Don't get it twisted here.
No, but I mean like you had never, what am I trying to say? You already had the image of like, of Daniel Radcliffe and Hermione Granger and all of that. You'd already seen all of that before you read the books. That's a difference in perspective that we're going to have. Yeah, so I think that I had read maybe a chapter or two before seeing the movie because I was like, I should try and read this before seeing it. But it was probably like that morning that I decided now I should read it. But I saw the movie and I liked it. But then I read the book and I just couldn't get into it. It was a very odd sensation.
Okay. So the first book didn't, originally, back in the day, didn't do it for you.
Didn't do it for me, and I'm, you know, very ashamed to announce this to the world, but I actually skipped large chapters of the book and then just went straight to, like, the second book. I was like, I'm kind of over this. I know what happens.
Okay.
I'm going to the Chamber of Secrets.
Wow, you are blowing my mind right now.
You gotta have some secrets, even within a sisterhood of 29 years.
For real. Okay, well, how old were you the first time you read this?
Oh, I was in fifth or sixth grade.
You would have been, because the movie came out when I was in sixth grade. So the movie came out when you were in fourth grade.
Then I was in fourth grade.
Okay.
Yeah. So I waited until the movie came out before I read the books.
Interesting. Okay, I was in fourth grade as well when I read the book for the first time, but that was just 2 years earlier.
Yeah, and you have been nagging me for 2 years to read this book.
Absolutely,
Edie, yes. You're going to like it so much. It's great. It's
why
awesome.
You didn't read it for 2 years.
And I was like, angsty AF.
Don't tell me what to do.
Yeah, don't tell me what books to read. I know what books to read. I read books.
Book reader.
Yeah. Hot take. It's really good.
Oh my god. Hilarious. Okay, so we are going to walk through the book more or less chronologically, and because I took a ton of notes, I'm going to kind of lead the discussion, and you are going to freestyle this.
Total Ravenclaw, Gryffindor vibes here.
I was going to say, we're going to get more into our houses later, but wow, you're a Gryffindor, and I am a Ravenclaw. To a T. Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty. So the book starts off at the Dursleys, and I thought this was genius. I didn't remember that the book started off kind of from the Dursleys' point of view. And so you've got the perspective from the Dursleys, and it's the day that Voldemort killed Harry's parents and tried to kill Harry and was defeated. But you're living that experience through the Dursleys. So what did you think of that perspective?
I noticed that as well this time around, and I thought it was super smart, because to introduce you into a world of magic, it can be like a little much to begin with. So to make it seem more real, you come in through the viewpoint of a muggle, and mm-hmm. as a muggle, you're going to relate to them and believe their story more.
Yeah.
So it felt more real this time around, noticing that and being cognizant of the fact that you're being introduced in that manner.
Absolutely. And I thought, you know, like learning this whole new world, there's a whole new language essentially that you have to learn. And beginning with the Dursleys' perspective, it's like you get to be confused as the reader. But you're supposed to be confused because you will have the same amount of knowledge as the Dursleys.
Yeah.
So you're not reading it and being like, oh my gosh, I'm so stupid. I don't understand this book. You're like, oh, wait, what? They don't know what's going on either. Like, what is going on?
Well, and I think that also allows you to feel more like the main character of Harry Potter, because he's also just thrown into this world and he has no idea what everything is and, you know, what magic can even do. So I think that was a really great way to connect with the character, because you're thrown off kilter as well.
Absolutely. Okay, so my next question is super random, and it's actually not going to make any sense now, knowing what I know, knowing that you saw the movies first. So I read the first three books before I ever saw the movies, and I read them in fourth and fifth grade. And I also must have skipped over large chunks because I had a very clear imagination of what Hogwarts looked like. And it's just like, it's literally not how it's described in the book. It's just how I decided to imagine it. Like, I imagined Dumbledore as just a regular principal. So I imagined him in like a suit and tie and like clean shaven. And I remember talking to mom about it, and she's like, no, he looks like Merlin. What are you talking about? And I was like, oh, well, skip that part. Wasn't interested in that description. So my next question was going to be, how big did you think Hagrid was? Because I just thought he was, like, huge. I imagined this, like, massive human being, like, couldn't fit in a building. And it's, like, it's not how he's described.
You know,
I was hoping I wasn't the only one, but apparently I'm assuming I'm the only one.
I mean, I did think that he was going to be bigger. Like I said, I think I read the first, like, two chapters beforehand. I imagined him a little bit less coordinated as well.
Okay.
Like, I just felt like he's half giant, and giants are, like,
big and stupid. I don't picture them being graceful, like, either.
Yeah, so I thought he would just be bigger and less well-kept than Hagrid is portrayed in the movies.
Okay. So I'm not totally alone on this island.
No, but I did assume that he could, like, fit through at least some doorways.
I pictured him probably 12 to 15 feet tall. Like,
that
a sizable person. It's just not how he's described in the book.
Yeah, and Dumbledore's not in his suit tie, so.
He's not at all. Okay, so chapter 4. In chapter 4, this is when Harry hears the story of his parents' death for the first time. And it's when Hagrid tells him the story. And while Hagrid is telling the story, Harry kind of has this flashback memory, and he remembers the sound of Voldemort's laugh. And I just want to know, because Harry was a baby, so there's no way that he actually had that memory stored. Do you think that he could hear that laugh, like, as a memory because he's a Horcrux?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I feel like that's
the only way. So is that where all the flashbacks come from?
Yeah, because, like, the memory of Voldemort is stored within a Horcrux.
Yeah.
So the memory of...
Oh, that's so true.
That and it's, like, the period of time that he, like, creates it, isn't it? Like, because, I mean...
Oh, okay. I don't remember that part of it. But that would make sense. So, yeah, he's literally going to have some of Voldemort's memories. I never thought about it that way, because I know that, like... Obviously, when a Horcrux has a piece of a person, but I guess I never really, like, connected the memory piece. So, yeah, of course he's gonna have some of his memories.
I just feel like it's one of those things where you're not gonna have it most of the time, but then if it gets, like, triggered, then it's gonna be, like, bing, bang, boom.
That makes sense.
Here's all these things, you know?
That totally makes sense. And with Harry being the last Horcrux... And Voldemort was already so fragmented, it would make sense that, like, the memories that he gets are just, like, weird little flashes.
Yeah, and it's just, like, that moment. It's the blinding green light and him laughing.
Okay.
You know, that's all that he had to give.
So that's something I obviously didn't pick up on the first time, because book 7 didn't exist when I read book 1.
You literally couldn't have known.
Also, I thought Dumbledore looked like a regular elementary principal, so I was not going to pick up on the Horcrux.
Let's keep on reverting back to Dumbledore is not a regular principal. He's a cool principal.
He's a cool principal. Okay, so presenting more random thoughts by Ziana, chapter 5, we get Diagon Alley, and I had some reactions to things that happened in the chapter Diagon Alley. And so I want to hear your reactions to the following.
Okay.
So, this is a quote. You know, Harry's walking through Diagon Alley, and he's never seen wizards before. He's never seen any of this. It's all very overwhelming. And so he's asking Hagrid questions. And so he goes, Harry asks, wizards have banks? And Hagrid says, just the one, Gringotts, run by goblins. React.
My first reaction was, there are wizards all over the world. And how are you supposed to... I know that, like, the flu network gets you from here to there really fast, and you can, you know, there are lots of magical ways to transport yourself. But you're telling me that every time I want to get some of my nuts and sickles out, I
one,
I have to just go to England?
One bank.
It's the one bank.
One bank.
I feel like that's a pretty flawed system. And so, like...
Yes.
Like, you're telling me that we can't have, like, a Gringotts in the U.S. You can't have a Gringotts in...
Seriously. You know. And, like, transportation is an issue, a common theme of an issue throughout the books. Because, yes, like, there are faster ways. You've got the flu network. You can apparate. But, like... You can't apparate, like, under a certain age, so most people aren't apparating with their children. Like, it's an issue to get from point A to point B, and you're telling me you have one bank. Okay, so that was my first issue. Yeah. My second react to the following. So, he sees wizarding money for the first time, and, you know, he's never, like, heard of these things before, so... Hagrid starts to explain.
Please tell me that this is...
Just wait.
This
just
is
wait.
The currency conversion.
Just wait! A galleon, one galleon, equals 17 sickles, and one sickle equals 29 newts. React. This is stupid.
I feel like J.K. Rowling was just like, I want to mess with people so bad. They're never going to know how much anything is. Like there's no even conversion. They're like, it...
Absolutely. It's like, these people have magic. I just want to take everything else away from them. They get one bank. And just the worst currency system ever. We have to slow these people down or else they'd be unstoppable.
Yeah. Well, all they have are these giant coins. And can you imagine, like, oh, I ran out of my sickles, so we're only going to be paying you in, you know, or gnuts or what?
I call them newts, but it might just be D's nuts. Because that's how I feel about this system. It just doesn't make any sense.
It seems a bit ridiculous that you need 29 of anything, but then again, we're over here with the penny, so.
I think about what a nightmare it is to teach first graders about currency, and they're always so confused about, like, why is the nickel larger than a dime? For our American audience, you're familiar with this, but, like, it's always hard for kids to, like, kind of grasp this and understand, but at least, like, we're counting up in increments of 5. I cannot imagine, like, well, one of these is 17 of these is 29 of these. Like, just quit.
Well, and Hagrid just
explains
it. And
no one's out here paying with a credit card either. Like, they're out here using these coins.
Yeah. One, it seems like a really heavy form of currency.
Mm-hmm.
Two, Hagrid just explains it the once. He just says it so matter-of-factly, and then Harry's just like, yep.
This kid,
I got it.
He's 11.
Have you ever been with an 11-year-old who's trying to pay for anything?
Have you ever told an 11-year-old something one time and then experienced them ask you that same thing 27 more times? Like, that's just the way it goes.
I'm 29 years old and I still had a very difficult time with the conversion, or with the currency.
Yes. Yeah. This is ridiculous. Okay, moving on.
Okay.
Because I've got
that's a whole podcast in and of itself.
Wizarding money. I mean, what if the goblins want to just, like, if they could run up inflation, they could do all kinds of things.
Strike, okay. You know.
Moving on. Okay, so Harry's wand, when he is in Ollivander's, it shoots up red and gold sparks. So is that, like, kind of announcing or, like, foreshadowing that he's going to be a Gryffindor?
Oh, I never thought about that.
But... I literally don't know, because you never... At least I don't think so. I don't remember ever in the books reading about another wizard's experience of getting their wand. So we don't know. Maybe it's like red and gold sparks is just the standard sign for everyone. But we don't know that. So it just kind of seemed like a Gryffindor thing.
In my mind, I think that everyone has their own, like, special experience. Because the wand chooses the wizard. And each wizard and wand connection is going to be different. So yes. I feel like... it wouldn't be necessarily the same for each one.
Okay. That makes sense. Okay, so chapter 7, The Sorting Hat.
Oh.
Obviously, I'm skipping around some chapters, but these are the ones that impacted me. Obviously, the important parts. So, The Sorting Hat's song in the first book is as follows. You might belong in Gryffindor, where dwell the brave at heart. Their daring, nerve, and chivalry set Gryffindors apart. You might belong in Hufflepuff, where they are just and loyal. Those patient Hufflepuffs are true and unafraid of toil. Or yet in wise old Ravenclaw, if you've a ready mind, where those of wit and learning will always find their kind. Or perhaps in Slytherin, you'll make your real friends. Those cunning folks use any means to achieve their ends. So we have already kind of discussed that you are a Gryffindor, mm-hmm. and I'm a Ravenclaw. So I just want to know, like, when you were younger, like 10 years old, when you started reading these, did you always identify as a Gryffindor, or is that something that kind of developed later?
I think I always identified as a Gryffindor, honestly, even more so then. I struggled real big time with impulse control, and so I feel like that's where they're like, yeah, Gryffindor, you are brave, and I'm like, no, I'm just stupid, and I'm not afraid of this because I haven't thought this through.
I was not able to connect the dots to realize I should maybe be afraid of this.
Yeah, I was okay. Not using any part of the Ravenclaw mind of like, let's go through all this methodically and figure okay. this out. So identified hard as a Gryffindor.
Gryffindor right off the bat.
Yeah.
Okay. I had a similar experience. I always identified as a Ravenclaw. At least I don't remember identifying as anything else. So I feel like for me, going through that Sorting Hat song, it starts off with Gryffindor and it's like mm-hmm. brave at heart, daring, nerve, chivalry. That is so not me. At all, and never has been. Like, you know, I was always the one to, like, chicken out on everything. Or, like, I would always make you try stuff first. Like, I'd come up with a fun idea and be like, hey, you should test this out and see if it's safe. And then you, all Gryffindor energy, would be like, okay. Yeah. And then if you got hurt, you'd be like, are you gonna try it? I'd be like, no. Saw you get hurt. Not gonna do it.
No, I distinctly remember one time you told me to climb the tree and I should... Yeah, we had a tree in our backyard, and she told me to climb up and, like, go on this specific branch. And, you know, turns out that branch was dead. An 8-year-old didn't realize that.
Well, me as a 10-year-old also didn't realize that.
No.
Else I wouldn't have told you to. I told you to, like, kind of, you could kind of, like, from sitting on top of the branch, if you held onto this other branch, in my mind, you'd be able to kind of swing out and hang off of it. So mm-hmm. she went to do that, except the branch immediately snapped, so she just fell, like, I don't know, probably wasn't that tall, but you probably fell, like, a good 6 feet, just, like, straight onto your back.
Yeah, that did not feel great, but that was pure Gryffindor.
Pure Gryffindor.
You were like, you should do this, and I was like, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, why wouldn't I climb the tree? Why wouldn't I
And I never, ever, ever have had that, so I was like, nope, not a Gryffindor. Then you go to Hufflepuff. Where they are just and loyal, those patient Hufflepuffs are true and unafraid of toil.
Dude.
So I literally wrote in here, what was the house that you absolutely would not want to be in, and why is it Hufflepuff? Because that's how I always felt about Hufflepuff.
That's how I felt originally in reading it. I was like, they're just, you know, like, so weak and whatever. And in rereading it, I'm like, they are just, so they're gonna make, like, good choices.
Mm-hmm.
They're loyal. They are patient and, like, they're unafraid of toil. You're not afraid of conflict and resolution. I'm like, these are all really strong characteristics. And honestly, it's probably why Hogwarts was even able to be formed, because of the ability of the Hufflepuff name
Absolutely.
Being able to, like, smooth over these things where they're like, I don't need to have the ego. I
the
don't
Hufflepuffs
need to win.
Are the backbone of Hogwarts. They're definitely the most well-adjusted people. They're the ones you're going to want to be friends with.
Mm-hmm. Best co-workers.
But me reading that, I just feel like the Sorting Hat always screwed them over, and we'll do this in all the books, because
yeah.
I feel like every Sorting Hat song, one of them literally, I think, says, like,
Dear Hufflepuff, she took the rest.
So you're a leftover. Like, I never... My ego was way too big to be a leftover.
You're magical, but, like... You're not really showing anything, like,
yes.
nothing of great promise.
I would agree with you. I would say now, reading through these, I'm like, Hufflepuff is definitely the best, and that's who we should admire. I still don't think I'm a Hufflepuff. Like, I'm not that good. I'm not that nice. But my opinion on Hufflepuff has definitely done a 180
yeah.
since childhood.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. We're going to skip forward to chapter 9, The Midnight Duel. So that was the episode, or the episode, that was the chapter that ends with, like, Malfoy trying to trick them to come to a duel at midnight. Mm-hmm. But the beginning part of this chapter is phenomenal. This is where they learn how to fly on broomsticks for the first time. And I want to know who the heck okayed Neville Longbottom to be able to fly on a broomstick. This is just being bad at your job. Madam Hooch, come on.
Well, I mean, Neville's grandma tried her best for a really long time to keep him off of a broom. And, you know, magic, learning, you know, skills, all of it's dangerous. I mean, they have potions that are, like, exploding. They've it's got, you know, things that are transfiguring into objects that are dangerous. They're going into, you know, freaking dark, or forbidden forest.
So you can't, like, bubble wrap him, I guess. Yeah. But I just was like, that, I mean, we all knew it was going to end in the hospital wing, and it just immediately ends in the hospital wing.
My question for that is, why did Madam Hooch feel that she had to be the one to walk Neville up to Madam,
Oh, she is just, like, straight up not good at her job. She's that teacher that, like, when she's there, you know you can't get away with anything, but, like, she's always on her cell phone the whole time, so you know you can get away with it. Like, that's the energy I'm picking up from Madam Hooch.
Yeah, no, Neville just, like, goes and breaks his wrist, and she's like, I should leave all these 15 other kids by themselves with a broom for the first time, and also, I'll just tell them, don't get on it.
Also, I'm gonna throw this out there. She is the one that, like, teaches hundreds of children how to fly. She's out here on the Quidditch pitch. Like, maybe you should learn how to fix a broken bone. Like, I have to learn CPR to work with children. You should learn some magic spells that can help kids.
Yeah.
Okay. So, after Neville is taken to the hospital and Madam Hooch just completely abandons all these children with broomsticks, because that's a great idea, that is when Malfoy steals the Remembrall from Neville, and he, like, flies up into a tall tree, or flies it up in the air, and he's, like, trying to hide it. And this is when Harry, for the first time, has never been on a broomstick before, like, big Gryffindor energy, just decides, I'm gonna get that. And he, like, launches himself up, and he's flying around, and it's amazing. And I made a note that this is, like, the first time we really see Gryffindor energy from Harry.
Yeah. No, Harry, leading up to this point, I feel like Harry was still adjusting to the magical world and just being, like, in awe of things. And, you know, like, really the muggle in him was just, like, I don't belong. I shouldn't be here. And that's the first time he's, like, I don't like Malfoy. This is my homeboy Neville. Don't take his stuff. Stop being so rude. I'm sick of it. What are you going to do? Like, what's the worst that can happen? I'm going to fall down and break my wrist? Whatever. I've been abused by my cousin for the last 11 years of my life. This isn't a big deal. And I love when he's up there and he confronts Malfoy and he's like, you're not so brave up here without Crabbe and Goyle. And it's the first time you kind of get, like, snarky Harry, like, really coming at him. And seeing how much of a baby Malfoy is.
Yeah.
Like,
they had already at this point, like, kind of had words with each other, but I feel like this really solidifies, like, their feud.
Yeah.
Of, like, we're just gonna mess with each other for the next 7 years. And Harry's like, bring it, because I'm not scared of you.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of you. But also, like, Malfoy is not a weak wizard. Malfoy is up there on the broomstick, flying around, doing a good job. He is someone who, like, might talk a way too big game for what he's actually capable of doing, but, like, somewhat he can back it up.
This is true. I've never really thought about it that way. And this moment gives us something that I would like to introduce to the podcast that we're going to call Minerva moments.
Oh, love Minerva.
I said, put respect on her name. Minerva McGonagall is a legend and we don't deserve her.
Oh, yeah. I love that she comes down looking like she is just so angry, just gonna tear him to shreds. And then she's like, I am so sick of losing. I am a competitive, because she's Gryffindor. I am competitive. I am brave. I make gutsy moves. And usually I'm straight-laced and stuff, but I'm so freaking sick of Professor Snape putting down Gryffindor, and we need a seeker.
We need a seeker. We need to win. So that is the official first Minerva moment from the books. When she, yeah, you think he's going to get in trouble, but she just poaches a seeker for her team. Mm-hmm. Or I guess doesn't poach. She recruits a seeker for her team.
Makes special accommodations. She makes it happen. She makes it happen for herself.
For herself. And also, I wanted to talk about this. So I love that Minerva is the head of Gryffindor. Because all of those traits that we see described for Gryffindor, like brave and daring and stuff, like those are traditionally masculine traits. Mm-hmm. And obviously, women and non-binary people have had those traits throughout history, for sure. But yeah. They are just, like, they're more traditionally assigned to masculinity, and to anyone who identifies as being masculine, like, those traits can be celebrated. And if you identify as anything else, sometimes those traits get a negative reputation of, like, you're not brave, you just won't shut up. Like, yeah. You won't go with the flow, you're difficult. And I like that she is all of those things. She's brave, she's daring, she's competitive, and they're celebrated. So I was like, yes, I love that, like, Gryffindor, lion energy, is a woman.
Yeah.
And it's an old woman.
Yeah.
Like, that's another thing, the elderly. Like, you don't think of the elderly as, like, brave, not loyal, brave, daring. Like, you're just like, oh, they're an old person. And she's like, no. I'm Minerva McGonagall.
Well, and everyone respects her. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where, like, even, like, Peeves respects, to some extent, McGonagall more than, I mean, she's not the Bloody Baron, but,
yeah,
like, Snape is going to put respect on Minerva's name.
Absolutely.
Dumbledore respects Minerva. Like, Flitwick. All of them.
Yeah, she's someone that everyone goes to.
Yeah, because she's going to get it done. Minerva. And she's going to get it done well. She's going to get it done quickly. She's going to, you know, be discreet when necessary. And she's never going to do something that she can't back up. Like, her punishments are always just, and she's never going to be more harsh on one than the other, but she expects greatness out of you, and that's why she's a great teacher. She's going to be super difficult, but if you can deal with her, you can make it in the real world.
Absolutely. You brought up a great point that I can't believe I left out of my notes, so we're going to talk about this really fast. Peeves, I love him, and I will forever be freaking pissed that he's not in the movies.
I am just angry about, like, all of the ghosts don't really get that much of a storyline, which, like, ends up being a big part of, like, the whole series. I love Peeves so much. Peeves is so much fun and character and flavor.
He's such a great obstacle.
Yeah.
Like, he can always screw up your plan.
Yeah. He just shows up places, and then he just throws chalk at you.
I just think that leaving Peeves out was a really terrible mistake, and I'm going to be mad about it forever.
There are several things in the movie series that I'm very frustrated that were included or not included, and that is the first one that really was bothersome for me.
Absolutely. Okay, chapter 10, Halloween. And this is where...
Troll in the dungeon!
Troll in the dungeon! We'll get to that performance on our next episode.
Thought you should know.
But this is the turning point in their relationship with Hermione. So up to this point, Hermione was, like, the annoying know-it-all who was always telling on everybody. And after they, you know, it's kind of their fault that she gets locked in the bathroom with the troll and they go and save her. And there's this really cute quote from the book that I'm going to read. It says, "But from that moment on, Hermione Granger became their friend. There are some things you can't share without ending up liking each other. And knocking out a 12-foot mountain troll is one of them."
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I thought that was, like, a really cute way. Not cute, but, like, a great way to get the three of them together. Because logically, they don't make sense as a friendship group. But that's totally true. Everyone has that, like, terrible job that you worked with coworkers and you're, like, lifelong friends. Yeah. Or you played on a sports team or you had, like, a traumatic event. And any other time in life, these wouldn't be your people. But you come through at the other side and you are so much stronger for it. And you're thankful for these people being in your life And that's an unshakable bond.
Absolutely. So up to that point, like up to chapter 10, what had your impression of Hermione been? Like, did you find her annoying or did you like her?
You know what? After talking to you about Minerva and like the traditionally masculine presentation of bravery mm-hmm. and all that, that's totally what you see for Hermione up mm-hmm. into that point. Because you are coming at it from a masculine point of view. You're coming at it from Harry's point of view. And so it's like, she is annoying. She is kind of a lot to handle. She's
bossy.
Yeah.
She knows that she's really smart mm-hmm. and she knows it. And she wants everyone else to know it too.
Yeah. And for anyone else, it might be a little annoying, but like it really is portrayed up until that point that she's just like way too much to handle. No wonder no one wants to be friends with her. And you're like, what? Because she's really good, because she wants to get the top marks in your class, because she's a muggle and yeah. she's just like crushing the game. Like, sorry that you're just coasting by on this mediocrity.
Absolutely.
Like, Hermione, like Minerva, is not going to let you be mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
And I like once they become friends, when they're like, Hermione wouldn't let us, you know, copy her homework, but you could ask her to, you know,
yeah. proofread it. Questions or proofread it. Yeah, you'd still get the answers. You'd still
get the answers, right. But she's never going to just give you the answers. She still wants you to work for it and try. And you might not have to try as hard, but she's still going to make you work.
Yeah.
But she wants you to succeed.
I love Hermione, too.
Hermione is an absolute queen, and that is one that I saw different. I imagined differently even after reading the book, after seeing the movie.
Okay.
Her description is so much different from Emma Watson.
Okay.
Looks-wise.
Yeah, I guess looks-wise, though, is hard, because you have to find the best actor, and they may not necessarily look exactly like the description. Okay, so we're going to move on to chapter 12. Which is the Mirror of Erised?
Erised?
Okay.
That's how I say it.
Erised? I don't know. I'm going to go with Erised. So, J.K. Rowling really sets the tone at the beginning of this chapter that we've, like, transitioned from fall into winter. And she paints this beautiful picture of, like, the Hogwarts grounds. And it's all cold and snowy. And I want to get your reactions to some of these things. So, they say, they're talking about how it's, like, really warm and cozy in the common rooms because they have a fireplace, mm-hmm. but everywhere else inside the castle is freezing cold, and it is apparently so cold in Snape's classroom in the dungeons that you can see your breath. And I wrote down a note that said, I'd rather be a muggle, at least we have heat.
I don't know why you are in the wizarding world and the only way to heat a giant castle is, you know, through a fire.
A wood-burning fire.
You can create flames that you can hold in a jar and keep you warm, but you can't just, like, have heating ducts. You don't have the ability to, like, heat water and run it, like, underneath mm-hmm. the floors to, like, heat from the floor up. You have the ability to make the ceiling into the night sky that looks no different than the outside, and you cannot heat the place up. I personally am always cold, so mm-hmm. this is my worst nightmare.
Yeah.
I'm just surrounded by cold stone 24/7.
I'll go to regular school. I'll do math in a warm classroom.
And Snape,
get out of here.
Snape, this is your classroom. You have to be there all day. Are you really, like, that warm-blooded?
There's always that one teacher that, like, has a freezing cold classroom and is always like, well, I really like it. And I feel like I get that energy from Snape. He's going to be like, well, I like the cold. And you're like, dude, I can see my breath. It's 40 degrees inside.
You know what?
This is a problem.
His classroom is probably the smelliest, though. And there's a difference from, like, a hot smell and also a cold smell. So maybe it was just in reaction to working with 11-year-olds that have, you know, that are brewing potions.
These are the problems that I would address with my magic.
Yeah.
I would address heat.
Hygiene.
Hygiene. Can we get some airflow in this dungeon? I mean, come on. Okay, so another thing about the magical world that I was like, get out of here, I'd rather be a muggle. So they learn about the name Nicholas Flamel and that there's something, you know, mysterious being hidden in the castle. Mm-hmm. It's between Dumbledore and Nicholas Flamel, and they're like, oh, who is this guy? And they spend the whole time, like, reading through the library, and they can't figure out who Nicholas Flamel is. And I said, after, you know, I'd rather be a muggle, at least we have heat, we also have Google.
Yeah. You guys don't have, like, a singular database that you can do. You can't, like, hold your wand up to your throat and say, searching for Nicholas Flamel, and then have them be like, here are 40 books on Nicholas Flamel.
Right? And I looked up when this book was published, and it said 1997, so maybe she was writing this before then, so maybe there's a slight chance that this is, like, pre- search engine days, but I know for a fact when I read it in, like, 1998, 1999, I mean, I was asking Jeeves questions.
Yeah.
Which, for those of you who don't know what Ask Jeeves is, be grateful. It was not a good search engine, but it had a fun name, so.
And an internet butler that would find irrelevant materials.
I think you had to phrase everything as a question. I don't know. Some weird stuff with Ask Jeeves. Anyways, yeah, it just, the magical world is very impractical, even though they have magic.
Yeah.
The next point that I want to address, this has to do with their Christmas party.
Mm-hmm.
So, I love the Christmas party moment. It's like everyone is eating together in the
Great Hall,
and it's like a feast. And she mentions that Dumbledore is wearing a flowered bonnet at the feast.
Yeah.
And so, at, like, basically at the conclusion of the series, I think it was right before the last book came out, or maybe even after it came out, J.K. Rowling announced that she had always imagined Dumbledore as being gay,
mm-hmm.
even though I personally never got the impression that he was gay. I was younger, and I had no sense of a gaydar, so I'm sure even if she made it more obvious, it still would have gone over my head. But I just wanted to know, like, do you think that putting him in a flowered bonnet was her, like, one of her weird little nods at, like, maybe he's gay?
I don't know. I just feel like, what I got from that is he's out here enjoying time, mm-hmm. and he is known for being kind of kooky and mm-hmm. off the wall. Like, his beginning toast before the sorting ceremony or after the sorting ceremony, he says something about, like, warts and wizards and something completely random, and that's his toast. It's like four words long, and it's complete hogwash.
Yeah.
And I use that word because I feel like Dumbledore would really enjoy it.
He would love a hogwash, yes.
I never got the impression, but I also was 11, and I got the impression that they are wizards at school.
Absolutely.
And, like, nobody was interested in anyone else. Like, there was no tension between characters other than, like, Malfoy and Harry hated each other.
Yeah.
That's the only kind of tension I was picking up on.
I didn't think so either. I guess I was more so thinking, like, if that was one of her little clues that he was gay, like, what a terrible clue.
Yeah.
Like, how half-hearted is that?
Yeah.
But we can get more into that as the series continues. We have our second Minerva moment that happens at the Christmas party. So Hagrid gets a little toasty, mm-hmm. and he's sitting next to Minerva, and he gives her a kiss on the cheek, and you expect her to be kind of, like, put off by it or
taken aback. Yeah.
And it says she doesn't get mad, she just blushes. And I thought that was so cute that they had a fun little moment. Like, they're just a little buzzed at the Christmas party.
Yeah. I don't have to be teaching right now. I'm off duty.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just here to have a good time. I'm with my friends.
He's a good guy.
Yeah. Hagrid's a good guy. Like, why not? Why not have your friend come and kiss you on the cheek and, you know, probably be singing you songs and cracking you up? I love it.
I love it. So then after the Christmas party, we get more into, like, the actual action that happens mm-hmm. in the Sorcerer's Stone. And so Harry had already found the Mirror of Erised, you know, and it showed him his family. And then he went and showed Ron the mirror as well. And it showed him, like, being head boy and Quidditch Cup and all that stuff. And at this point, he has the invisibility cloak that mm-hmm. was still a mystery, like, who gave it to him. And so one of the times that he goes back Dumbledore, like, pops up out of the room, and he tells Harry that he doesn't need a cloak to be invisible, which I thought was kind of weird. Does that just mean he has, like, a spell that he knows how to make him invisible? Yeah. And I would assume that that's a more, like, difficult spell, or is just, like, every wizard out here just able to be invisible?
I think that Dumbledore is one of the greatest wizards of the time period. Okay. And so it's like, I have reached this point, this point of, like, enlightenment where I can make myself invisible. I don't need the cloak. But it makes you wonder, which, you know, the foreshadowing of, like, why do you need the cloak? Why did you have Harry's father's cloak?
Yeah.
What's the point if you can make yourself invisible? Yeah. But
I just basically got the impression from rereading this book that Dumbledore is actually pretty shady.
Oh, Dumbledore is super shady. He's like,
he's not a good mentor.
He straight up says that himself when they're like, we wanted you to be Minister of Magic, you know, later on. And he's like, no, I didn't trust myself with it.
Yeah.
Because I don't make great decisions. Yeah. I can make some great decisions.
That's true.
But also, I think that he also addresses Harry of, like, you're back again. So it leads you to assume that he was there in the room, you know, invisible.
Mm-hmm. Watching him. That was going to be kind of my next question was, like, so he clearly, this is the first time he really meets Harry. So he's just been, like, watching him from afar this whole time. Hasn't really introduced himself, which, again, is weird. If you're the person who basically arranged for where he's going to live for the last 11 years, you don't even bother to go say hi. It's weird. But then he also says to Harry, like, he tells him that they're going to be moving the Mirror of Erised and, you know, warns Harry not to go looking for it. But he says, quote, if you ever do run across it, you will now be prepared. So was he just, like, wanting Harry to go look for the Sorcerer's Stone?
I think, okay, first off, I don't think that he was out here just, like, watching Harry. When Harry first discovers the Mirror of Erised, the door is already open to that room. I think that Harry went in to this moment of where Dumbledore is going to the mirror to experience this moment of intimacy of, like, what his deepest desires of his heart are, which, you know, you later find out is, you know, his sister.
It's a sister, yeah.
That he's, you know, there to see her, and he feels this insane amount of guilt over everything that's happened to her. And so I think that Harry comes in, and he's, like, so excited about getting away from Snape, he doesn't notice. And Dumbledore's just, like, he's been entranced in this moment. He's been here, and Harry comes in, and you're just, like, kind of curious. Like, what are you going to do? I just gave you this ability to be invisible as well.
Yeah.
Like, what are you going to do? And how do you take that moment away from someone who's never met their family?
Yeah.
You know, if he's sitting there just loving being surrounded by all these people who look like him, you don't want to steal that moment. And then I think that after that, Dumbledore was probably curious to see if Harry would come back, like so many others have.
Yeah.
And then that's when he reveals himself of, like, hey.
Okay.
You know.
It's more of a training wheel situation of, like, I let you look, but, like, tisk tisk.
Yeah.
No more.
And then I think that the saying at the end where he says, like, if you ever come across it again, then you'll know what to do. In the book, it actually states that, like, Harry got the feeling that Dumbledore almost was, like, if you get the chance to come across Voldemort, like, I kind of have this idea that Voldemort is trying to come back. But you have a right to confront this part of your past.
Yeah.
You have a right to your history now. So if you're going to be there, you might as well be somewhat prepared. And it's kind of like Karate Kid-esque of, like, you know, wax on, wax off. You're like, this doesn't make any sense. But, like, eventually it comes to fruition of being helpful.
Very true. Chapter 13 is Nicholas Flamel. That is the title of the chapter. And we get an important Quidditch match in this game. So this is The Quidditch match before this was the one where Harry's broom starts going all crazy and he's being cursed, and they think that Snape is cursing him.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, we need to make sure that he's not cursed. So my first question for you is just about Quidditch in general. What position would you have wanted to play if you got to play Quidditch?
Oh, beater.
Beater, okay.
Hardcore, absolutely. Big
beater energy.
I do not want any of the pressure of scoring points or keeping points from being scored. Okay. Like, that's too much on me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to have a fun time flying around hitting things at people. I always said, like, I am not good at basketball, but I would be like, I am tall and I can be in the way. And that is what a beater does.
Big defense.
Yeah, I can just be tall, I can be in the way, I can be obnoxious. And that's really what I'm bringing to the table. No skill, no actual desire to fly around and find the snitch. That sounds awful.
No, that... So I, first of all, would never try out for the team. I just wouldn't play. So number one, I would play like fan. Yeah. I would be a spectator.
You're Lee Jordan out here. Just...
Yeah, but I don't even want to have to do that. I don't even want to have to pay attention to the whole game. I want to be in the stands. I mean, I do like watching sports, but yeah, no, Quidditch is like too intense.
Yeah.
I'm not a contact sport person. But I do think, I always thought if I were to play Quidditch that I would want to be a chaser.
Okay.
So chasers, you know, they're the ones that are flying around with the quaffle, trying to score some points. And what I love about the chaser is that, like, in 99% of the games that you play, your points don't matter.
Yeah.
It's like, whose line is it anyway? Yeah. This is a game where the points don't matter. Like,
you can just make the score, like, less bad.
Yes.
Like the...
So I love the idea of, like, yeah, maybe you scored a bunch of points, maybe you didn't score anything, and it's, like, totally chill. Like, it doesn't super matter. So I'm not competitive when it comes to sports, and no one would want me on their Quidditch team.
You're more of the Hermione. You're out here just stopping curses.
Are you kidding me? If Hermione was on the Quidditch pitch, like, she would get insanely competitive.
Oh, yeah. But she would be, like, all about the rules. She'd be like, they flew too close to this. And in this section, if you didn't see this, what are you, blind ref? That would be Hermione.
That would absolutely be Hermione. Okay. So... is a really important Quidditch match, and so therefore my question for you about it is super important.
Yeah.
So, again, Hermione and Ron want to stop Snape from cursing Harry, and they know that Snape is going to be refereeing the game. So they both bring their wands with them to the game, and Neville sees them, and he gets confused, and he asks them, like, why are you bringing your wands to the Quidditch game? And I just want to know... Like, don't wizards just bring their wands everywhere? Like, I just assumed that if you're a wizard, you just always have your wand on you. But Neville seems to think, like, that's not normal.
Yeah, I would think that that would be a normal thing. Like, your phone, you just keep it on you. But is it, like, I don't know, is it, like, bringing, a like, all your school gear with you?
These robes don't have pockets? They don't have a wand-shaped pocket, again, with the design flaws in the wizarding world.
Oh, and also the fact that wands can just be snapped. I'm like, you have made something that is so sit-on-able. Like, you could really just crack a wand.
Absolutely.
You tell me there's one wand for a wizard?
If you sat on it with certain angles, certain parts, you could damage the wand and your body with a wand.
Yeah.
This is not safe.
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay, the next chapter. Chapter 15, The Forbidden Forest. Okay, this is a weird question. I might just be totally wrong, but in The Forbidden Forest, they are serving their detention with Hagrid, and they are looking for the injured unicorn.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know, like, who's hurting the unicorn. So we know that it's Voldemort, but... I want to understand the mechanics of how this works. Is this, like, when he's not living inside Quirrell's head, like, he's just some floating demon out there? Or is, like, Nagini out there and helping him?
Neither of those. They say, you saw Quirrell drinking the unicorn's blood for me.
Oh.
So it's Quirrell out there. Okay. But, like, I think there's kind of, like, an ethereal, you know, like he's part Voldemort, mm-hmm. so it's going to sound weird. It's going to sound different. The you know, mechanics are going to be a little different. But I always imagined it, because I had seen the movie.
Yeah, the movie is like just, this weird floating thing.
Just Voldemort being its like spirit out here just nomming on unicorns. But actually, it was Quirrell that was ingesting it, which is why Quirrell, having not a pure soul, because he, you know, he compromised himself by drinking the unicorn's blood, which later comes into play.
Okay, absolutely. That makes sense. Thank you for that clarification. Okay, so also in this chapter, Harry, you know, he had lost the invisibility cloak, and then he gets it back. And he gets it back with a note that says, quote, just in case. And I just want to know, like, what does that mean? Again, Dumbledore, I don't trust him. Just in case of what?
I don't know.
Okay.
I do not know.
Well, I just want to know if you had any ideas. I just, again, feel like he's kind of, like, baiting him to go after the stone.
Yeah, I
That's the impression I got.
And keep in mind, back to the Forbidden Forest. Hey, so we know that something's been attacking unicorns, which are a very pure thing, in the Forbidden Forest. This unicorn's still going to be hurt in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
This unicorn is the second one to be attacked. And we think that four first-year students are going to be, like, our top-notch people to find this unicorn and also this being that's attacking them. Like, we know that attacking a unicorn is, like, this, like, heinous crime against humanity. So you're basically, we're going to send out the cast of Stranger Things to find murderers.
Yeah.
And, like, no, you're telling me that you couldn't get any of the teachers to volunteer to help this out. Dumbledore is not out here just, like, you know, making sure the grounds are safe.
The only person we're sending you with is Hagrid, who has a
broken third-year
education, a broken wand, and is forbidden from practicing magic.
But he, like, knows the creatures in there. And
but he's,
like
friends with some big spiders, so you're safe.
Yeah.
What? No, I'm calling big BS when they keep saying, like, the safest place in the world is at Hogwarts because of Albus Dumbledore, but they just do not care about their students.
Absolutely not. It's just
freezing them in the potions dungeon. Trolls are getting in. This is not safe.
It's not safe at all. I mean, you got Neville breaking an arm. There are certain things that you come to expect with, you know, like, it's going to be a little bit dangerous, but I love that Filch drops them off at, like, they meet at 11 p.m., and then he's like, I'll be here at sunrise to pick you up, or at dusk, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so you're telling me that these kids had a full day of school, and then you said, you need to stay up until 11. We're going to send you out sleep-deprived, we're going to send you out alone, and then just, like, send up some sparks if you see something.
Yeah, you don't get to sleep. What? Yes, Draco, you should absolutely be informing your father about this.
Yeah, Lucius would absolutely...
Lucius, shut this down. I'm supporting you.
Yeah, I'm pro about this.
Shut it down.
There's some things that need to change. Honestly, hanging kids by the wrists from, like, the metal shackles that Filch wanted to do, but they said that that's not the way that they discipline anymore. I'm like, that's a little bit more humane. Because at least you know what you're getting into.
At least you're not sending them out to Voldemort.
Yeah.
Okay, so then we get to chapter 16, The Trap Door. And this is where basically all the action of this book, this is one of the books where, like, literally everything action-wise happens in one chapter.
Yeah.
Which I actually kind of liked. But I have a question. I have a couple questions. My biggest takeaway from this chapter was, there's three options. Either Ron, Harry, and Hermione are exceptional wizards for their age. Just off the charts. Special. No one's ever been like them before. Or the Sorcerer's Stone straight up just was not well protected. Or the staff misplaced their trust that A, the staff wouldn't try to steal it, and B, the students would be too dumb to figure out it's there. So what do you think?
Well, my takeaway from this is I think that Fluffy was the only solid thing guarding this Sorcerer's Stone. Because unless you knew that she, or that they would go to sleep at the sound of music, that's the only way you could get past. That's the only one. And there's no logic, there's no skill, there's no nothing. You just to innately know this. Now, granted, Hagrid has a big mouth and he spilled the beans. Not necessarily your best form of trust. And then you, then you go to the devil's snare under the trapdoor. And you're like, so you just have to know something about
And this. A first-year student. I mean, Hermione is really smart, but, like, she's a first-year student, and she recognized this plant. So, clearly, another wizard gonna be able to recognize that.
Yeah. And then you get to the keys. And Ron, over here, not the smartest kid in the school, a little bit of street smarts. He's like, oh, you got a bunch of gold keys here? Well, this lock is silver.
Yeah.
So you're telling me you didn't throw in two or three other silver ones?
Harry is not the only wizard who's ever played Seeker. Yeah. So you could definitely get a Seeker in the group that's trying to, get the stone. And then next is the Wizarding Chest. Chess, not chest.
Also wondering, why were there three broomsticks? Like, why are there just so many broomsticks available? Like, maybe this should be, like, a one broomstick situation.
Right? And they kind of make it sound like, oh, like, Ron, Harry, and Hermione were able to get past because they worked as a team. The power of teams. And it's like, well, yeah, dark wizards have friends, too.
Yeah.
And, like, if you got a group of adults in there, I just feel like they would have flown through that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But then you go to Wizard's Chess. And again, that's a, like, that's a skilled thing to do.
Yeah,
but
you have to be good at chess. But, like, again, Ron is not the only person in the wizarding world that plays chess.
Not even the wizarding world. Just, like, the world. Like,
he's not Bobby Fischer.
It's chess. It's just that the pieces move and there's a little bit more high stakes.
Yeah.
And then after that, you had a troll. And are you, like, feeding this troll? Like, what's the situation on animals of being fed?
It seems like troll abuse a little bit. Like, justice for the troll.
Yeah. Like, why are you held underneath Hogwarts as this, like, weird way to protect something?
Also, that just doesn't even seem to be that hard to get past.
Yeah. Yeah, Quirrell had already taken care of it, so they just, like, walk right through. And then Snape's, like, logic and the whole thing of being, like, you take this potion and, well, so many wizards are good at spells, but they're not good at logic. And I'm like, you can't read?
Okay, but we have firmly established in this episode there really is no logic in the wizarding community. They have one bank.
Okay, yeah.
We're not sure if they have pockets for their wands in their robe.
Because you don't take your wand to things.
You need a 17 to 1 to 29 conversion ratio and just just pounds and pounds of gold coins to buy things. Like, this is just a stupid system. So I think that's where most wizards would have perished. Yeah. And that's why it took Hermione, a muggle born, to solve it.
I get that. And then you get to the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing to protect you is the Mirror of Erised. And you just had to want to find it and not use it.
I like that, though, because that one is, like, that just weeds out character.
Yeah.
So I think that's really cool. You could be, like, a really great, powerful, smart, street smart wizard and not have pure intentions. Because why the heck would you go through all of that? Except for Harry, you know, if you don't want to use it. I just want to have this thing.
Yeah.
That's stupid.
It is stupid, but, like, it's not impossible. Like, it's not this impossible thing. Like,
that's true.
Okay,
this is one big issue I had with the ending. So we get to Quirrell, he reveals the turban, and you find out that Voldemort's been hiding under there all the time, right? But Harry gets up close, And before the turban is even taken off, Harry notices that the turban smells bad. Like, there's a weird odor being emitting from this turban. And I just want to know, Albus Dumbledore, if you are the most powerful wizard in the world, you didn't realize Voldemort was under that turban?
Well, they say at the very beginning when they're describing Quirrell and, like, his classroom, it smells like garlic. And there's rumors that he, like, ran into vampires in Albania or somewhere. And that he puts garlic under his turban to, like, ward them off at all times. So, like, Quirrell's just overall, like, a stinky dude.
Okay. Do you think that Voldemort can smell, and was the garlic turban situation? I mean, that sounds like a nightmare.
I think
you're smothered under there, but I guess if you're just, like, surviving.
I think that Voldemort probably has a smell, and Quirrell was like, I should just put garlic everywhere and, you know, kind of try and make it.
Freaking deal with it, Dark Lord.
Yes. But, like, if you made it seem like your classroom was always stinky, and then you're stinky, and you don't have garlic on you, then you just are, like, not going to assume that there's, like, a weird demon man
attached to your head. Low-key, not a bad disguise.
Not a bad disguise at all. I have a question, though.
Okay.
That you might not know the answer to, but it said that in the series that after Tom Riddle applied to be the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, that it's been cursed and, like, no one has lasted more than a year. But they say in the beginning that, like, Quirrell was used to be like this, like, and then he went and, like, had this experience and he came back and he was, like, super weird. And, like, that would have obviously been when Voldemort comes and takes over his body. But I'm like, so did you work at the school before? Or were you just, like, this well-known guy? Did you go to Hogwarts? Is, you know, what's your story?
That's a good point, because the way that they kind of describe it, like, it doesn't seem like it's Quirrell's first year teaching.
Yeah.
He defense seems like against the Dark defense Arts. Against it seems like, yeah, they kind of establish it that, like, that's what he does. Although, if we're going off of, that no one's had the job for more than a year, then maybe he taught a different subject before and switched to Dark Arts?
Or was he able to do a second year because Voldemort was with him?
Yeah, but then why is no one
suspicious?
Because I guess at that time period, everyone felt really, really safe that he wasn't coming back.
Yeah. Well, and it was just, like, this theory. Like, nobody ever stays in this position. But, like, how many schools have you gone to where the turnover rate is just, like, really high? I mean, clearly the school is dangerous. Like, know what? I'm over it. Like, this is not the vibe for me.
No. Okay, well, you know what? I bet we can find the answer for that. So I will do some additional research about Quirrell and figure out his story. Where'd he come from?
Yeah. I would like to read some fan fiction on
Quirrell. Need more answers about Professor Quirrell. So I just want to end with this, that I think Harry's greatest asset is being stupidly brave. He is fully Gryffindor. He has no self-preservation.
No.
None.
None at all. He is pure impulse, and he has good intentions behind what he does, but, like, he doesn't have, no sense of self-preservation, but also, like, why would you?
Yeah.
Like, I've kind of grown up in this terrible situation, and I, you know, like, I'm finally in a place where I love it, and I have people that I care about, and I'm, like, very protective of them. Like, I don't want them to experience loss. So, I mean, maybe that's, you know, a fueling factor there.
It's an asset that not everyone has, and that is kind of what sets him apart.
Yeah.
All right, well, we made it through the first book, The Sorcerer's Stone. So join us next week. We are going to be discussing Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, the movie.
And there will be lots to unpack.
Oh, we're going to have opinions.
Big time. Big time opinions.
Big time opinions. We have new podcast episodes dropping every Thursday, so be sure to listen to us wherever you get your podcast.
And subscribe.
And rate, preferably like a really great rating, because we're like really great.
Leave a comment, you know, let's hear some feedback.
And be sure to follow us on Instagram at The Basic Cinephile, follow us on TikTok at The Basic Cinephile, and follow us on Twitter at The Basic Cineph 1. That's Cinephile without the I-L-E and the number 1. We're going to have lots of fun and interactive Harry Potter content, stories, posts, you name it, trivia. I'm just making stuff up right now. We're going to have trivia now because I've said it. So be sure to follow us. And yeah, we'll see you next week.
Yeah. Have a great week, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.